The 1970s were, in many respects, the golden age of the American serial killer, which is, of course, not a good thing. From the shocking crimes of John Wayne Gacy and Ted Bundy to Samuel Little and David Berkowitz, this era was marked by violence and panic from the community and the country as a whole. While the guilt of these men was eventually exposed, not all brutal serial killers were caught. Some killers remain unknown for decades, either continuing their reign of terror or fading away from the headlines. One of the most notorious killers of this era did just that. This brutal killer got away with the murders of 6 children in just under 18 months, leaving the investigators stumped for decades to come. Then he disappeared. This is the case of the Freeway Phantom.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Mmm, boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? Mmm, and sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object.
Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.
On the evening of April 25th, 1971, the Phantom first made his mark on the world, and in the most gruesome fashion. 13-year-old Carol Denise Spinks was sent out by her sister to fetch groceries at a 7-Eleven located half a mile away. Her mother encountered her on the trip, scolded her for going out alone, and instructed her to come straight back when she finished at the store. Spinks duly picked up the groceries and began her journey home. That is when she vanished. The young girl had tragically been abducted off the street. 6 days later, her body was discovered on an embankment behind St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C. She was found lying alongside the northbound lanes of the I-295. An autopsy revealed that the young girl had been beaten, assaulted, and strangled. She had been killed just a few days before, with her abductor having kept her alive for some time. Although she was fully clothed, her shoes were missing, likely taken by the killer as a trophy, and it seems that they were just getting started. Less than 3 months later, the killer struck again. On July 8, 1971, with summer in full swing and Independence Day celebrations just passed, the mood in the nation's capital was joyous. Pedestrians were treated to the sounds of Carole King and the Bee Gees playing on radios throughout the day. At the same time, 16-year-old Darlenia Denise Johnson was on her way to her summer job at Oxon Hill Recreation Center. The teen was getting her first real taste of independent life. Tragically, her experience would be cut short. Darlenia was abducted that same day. Witnesses reported seeing Johnson in an old black car driven by an African-American male soon after the abduction. 11 days later, her body was found just 15 feet from where Spinks's body had been discovered. Police had been informed of the body's location nearly a week beforehand by an anonymous caller who knew details only the killer could have known. By the time police recovered the body, it was too decomposed to determine the cause of death or if an assault had occurred. Just like the victim before her, Johnson's shoes were missing. Interestingly, Johnson had lived just a few blocks away from Spinks, a potential clue as to where the killer may be residing. Despite the struggles with solving the case, the community's frustration with the police's lack of urgency would also be an ongoing occurrence throughout the case. Later that month, on July 27th, the killer claimed his youngest victim yet. 10-year-old Brenda Faye Crockett was taken from the streets of Washington, D.C. Crockett had been sent to the local store by her mother to buy dog food and paper and failed to return home. At around 9:20 p.m., the home phone rang and Brenda spoke to her younger sister. During that phone call, Brenda claimed to have been picked up by a white man. Brenda was crying. and said she thought she was in Virginia. Seemingly under duress, she abruptly said bye and hung up. Brenda's sister informed her mother's boyfriend while everyone else in the neighborhood was out searching for Brenda. When the phone rang a second time, he was the one who answered. Brenda repeated what she had said earlier, adding, "Did my mother see me?" and implying she was alone in a house with an unknown white male. When the boyfriend asked Brenda to tell the man to get on the phone, he heard heavy footsteps before Brenda hung up again. Police believed the phone calls had been made under the kidnapper's orders, with Brenda likely threatened and instructed on what to say. Brenda asking, "Did my mother see me?" was seen as the serial killer's attempt to find out if he was spotted while Brenda's mother canvassed the area looking for her. Also, the explicit insistence that the perpetrator was white led police to suspect the opposite, thinking the calls were meant to mislead them and hinder the investigation. Sadly, despite having a bit more information about the killer, it was too late to save Brenda. Her body was found in the early hours of the following day, along Route 50 near the Baltimore-Washington Parkway. She had been assaulted and strangled, and her shoes were nowhere to be found. The investigators were left unsettled by the speed at which the killer had murdered Denise Johnson and then Brenda Crockett. He was able to commit both crimes in less than 20 days without being caught. However, the fourth killing in the series wouldn't occur for another 2 months. On October 1st, 12-year-old Nenemoshia Yates was kidnapped from another street in D.C. Yates had been walking home from a Safeway store at around 7 p.m. Suddenly, she was abducted, assaulted, and brutally murdered by strangulation. The killer seemed rushed on this occasion, as the girl's body was found just 3 hours later, and very much out in the open. A witness described seeing Yates getting into a blue Volkswagen. Green fibers were found on her clothing, which investigators later determined came from a car rug linked to four other murders. Meanwhile, a clerk at Safeway reported finding the flour, sugar, and paper plates Yates had been buying in the street just minutes after she left, suggesting she had been abducted from that location. Her shoes were also missing, just like the three victims before her. Now being referred to as the Freeway Phantom after an article in the Daily News, the killer would become more brazen. The killing on November 15th showed several differences from the killer's established MO. The increasing publicity might have forced a change of habits, or perhaps he feared discovery. But the killing of Brenda Denise Woodard was distinctly different. At 18 years old, Woodard was the oldest victim of the killer. After having dinner with a high school classmate, she was headed home on a city bus at around 11:30 p.m. This was the last confirmed sighting of her. 6 hours later, her body was discovered near Prince George's County Hospital. She had been repeatedly stabbed and then strangled. Strangely, her shoes were still in place, and a coat had been placed over her chest. The differences in this killing might have led police to believe it wasn't the work of the Freeway Phantom, if not for the note found in one of her pockets. Seemingly torn from a school notebook and written by Woodard at her assailant's instruction, experts suggested that the handwriting indicated she may have known her kidnapper. The letter said, "This is tantamount to my insensitivity to people, especially women. I will admit the others when you catch me if you can. Freeway Phantom." Police believe that when Woodard wrote the note, she recognized who she was dealing with from the press coverage. She likely tried to fight back or flee, causing the killer to use the knife he carried as an insurance policy. Panicking about the blood and potential noise, he likely left her shoes behind. If Woodard's murder had been an aberration, the Phantom returned to his original method with his last known victim, Diane Denise Williams. Nearly a year passed before he struck again, kidnapping Williams on September 5th, 1972. The 17-year-old had been returning home from her boyfriend's house and boarded a bus at around 11:20 p.m., eerily similar to Woodard's last movements. As with the earlier victims of the Phantom, Williams's shoes were off her feet, but still present, placed alongside her body. Whether she had been assaulted or not wasn't immediately determined. traces of DNA fluid were found during the autopsy, and investigators initially believed it came from her boyfriend, who she had been with earlier that night. However, a later investigation determined the two had not engaged in intercourse. The DNA sample was subsequently sent to state police, where it was mishandled. It was then forwarded to the FBI, where it was never tested and eventually returned without analysis. Three questions arise from the killings. What was the intention behind removing the shoes? Why was the murder of Woodard different? And why did the killer pause his spree for nearly a year before murdering Diane Williams? In order to answer those questions, we need to try and look at the psychology of the killer.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? And sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object. Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
The removal of the shoes, likely taken as trophies, is not uncommon in serial killings. Notoriously, Jerry Brudos was known as the shoe fetish slayer, although Brudos's crimes predate those of the Freeway Phantom, having been active between 1968 and 1969. His story might provide insight into the type of person the Freeway Phantom could have been. Growing up, Brudos endured emotional and physical abuse from his mother, who had always wanted a girl. He developed a fetish for women's shoes at the age of 5, after playing with a stiletto shoe at a local junkyard. His urges were likely influenced by his mother's attitude. As he grew older, he attempted to steal women's shoes and eventually began physically assaulting local women in Salem, Oregon, stealing their shoes in the process. During psychiatric treatment, Brudos revealed that his sexual fantasies revolved around an intense hatred of women, particularly his mother. He went on to murder 4 women, possibly more. His crimes were gruesome. In one case, he cut off a victim's foot to display his stolen shoes, and in another, he used a dismembered breast as a paperweight. Applying this to the Freeway Phantom, it seems likely that any suspect would harbor a deep-rooted hatred of women. Additionally, a steady escalation of behavior would be expected, starting with thefts of women's shoes and progressing to acts of violence against women, likely of a sexual nature. With eyewitnesses suggesting an African-American male as the culprit, and all the victims being African-American, did the killer consciously choose victims from his own race? Perhaps he understood that these victims were likely to generate less police and press interest. After all, it took investigators 7 days to recover the body of Darlenia Johnson. The first 2 murders, with the victims living close by and being dumped in the same location, suggest a killer wishing to relive his experiences. Interestingly, there is a possibility that when Brenda Crockett asked, "Did my mother see me?" she had seen her mother while being searched for and was genuinely asking if her mother had seen her. Such a scenario would suggest the culprit was in the area being explored. Police later determined that the killer's base location was likely in Congress Heights. The killing of Brenda Woodard, which stands out as different, reveals one of 2 possibilities. Either the killer was cunning, having her write the note to avoid his handwriting being used as evidence, or he could not write due to his own limitations. He also used the nickname given to him by the press, something many serial killers angrily reject. One individual who may fit the profile of the Freeway Phantom is Robert Askins. 6 years after the killings, in 1977, Askins was charged with abducting and assaulting a 24-year-old at his home in D.C. During questioning, police learned that he had been charged with murder on several prior occasions, dating back to 1938. Askins was 19 and a member of the science club at Minor Teachers College when, just after Christmas, he served whiskey laced with cyanide to 5 prostitutes at a local brothel. Ruth McDonald, age 31, was killed by the mixture. 2 days later, while still at large, Askins returned to the same brothel and stabbed 26-year-old Elizabeth Johnson to death. After being arrested, Askins declared himself a woman hater and was sent for psychiatric evaluation. After assaulting several orderlies, he was deemed highly violent and criminally insane and was committed to St. Elizabeth's Psychiatric Hospital in the city. He was released in 1952 and promptly killed again, strangling 42-year-old Laura Cook just 5 months later. Notably, both Carol Spinks and Darlenia Johnson, the Phantom's first two victims, were found close to this hospital. It is astounding that Askins, who had attempted mass murder and killed three women, remained at liberty. He was indicted for Cook's murder and retried for the 1938 murder after being judged sane and able to stand trial. Sentenced to 20 years to life, his conviction was overturned in 1958. With that, he was free to potentially carry out the freeway phantom slayings. As a deep-seated and violent misogynist, Askins certainly fit the profile of the Phantom. However, there was little concrete evidence against him. Investigators found court documents in his home, where a judge had used the word tantamount, a term colleagues confirmed Askins used frequently. This uncommon word also appeared in the note found with Brenda Woodard's body, but this connection was insufficient for charges. Searches of Askins' home and backyard revealed nothing incriminating, and no substantial evidence could be pinned on him. Askins died in a Maryland institution in 2010, at the age of 91. When asked if he had anything to do with the 1970s killings, he denied involvement, telling a Washington Post journalist that he didn't have the depravity of mind required to commit any of the crimes. So if it wasn't Askins, who could it have been? The best lead police had in the case was potentially linking the crimes to a group of men who committed assaults and abductions in D.C. and Maryland. Members of the gang were interviewed separately. Eventually, one of them agreed to talk on the condition of anonymity. This inmate told investigators that one of his fellow inmates was involved in the killings. He identified the individual, the date and location of a crime the inmate had admitted to, and a signature detail of the murder that had never been released to the public. The information was accurate on all counts, leading police to believe a breakthrough was imminent. However, as police were working to crack the case, an election was happening in Maryland. One of the candidates, eager to showcase their law and order credentials, revealed to the press that an inmate at Lorton Prison was providing information about the Freeway Phantom case. The news quickly reached the inmate, who then denied ever providing any information and refused to speak further. No new leads have emerged since. The Freeway Phantom stole the lives of six young women, many of them children. The killer, whoever he was, shattered the lives of many and left families without any sense of closure. Despite initial interest from police and the press, the breaking of the Watergate scandal diverted essential police time and effort. With the lack of coverage, some have a sense of relief, feeling that the killings ceased as abruptly as they had begun. Others feel that the killings continued unabated due to a lack of interest from the police and press. Either way, the most important issue is that justice was never served. To this day, the identity of the Freeway Phantom remains still an unsolved mystery.
Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant, Sweet Tango Apples, guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples, too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at SweetTango.com.